She's to sick bay. The doctor should look at it as soon as possible.
It is the way in which we propagate our species. Please demonstrate how this is accomplished.
So, what's next?
Hi, and welcome to Casual Trek, the Star Trek recap and ranking podcast brought to you by Nerd and Ty and Teenage Peer Pressure. Cover up that murder, or you won't be popular with a bunch of jerks you'll lose touch with in a couple of years. I'm Charlie Etheridge Nunn, a writer and fan of Canadian Trauma Factory, known as Degrassi.
I'm Mars V. Lobato, and da 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 da. A science fiction writer and a fan of the BBC kids soap opera, which always wants to talk about issues about what the kids are experiencing, Grange Hill. A school with a body count in probably the double digits of both teachers and students, that it has to be built on some sort of cursed ley line or something.
Oh God, bound to be. Yeah. God, what a theme tune.
Oh man.
I didn't even see a massive amount of it, and it still sticks in the head.
The classic Grange Hill theme tune just kind of is just sticks in your head. but like, yeah, the amount of cruel, pointless death in that show gives Game of Thrones a run for its money. It's like, oh, the Red Wedding. Okay, well, what about the time someone died of a brain hemorrhage in Mr. Bronson's car?
Wow. Okay, well, I was going to say we've not got much death in this, but we do have some death in this, as we're going to be talking about three episodes of Star Trek based around Starfleet Academy and Starfleet Cadets, because Synergy, yes, we are imminently going to encounter the Star Trek Academy TV show. And, we figured why not get ready for it and get in the Starfleet Academy mindset. So, Miles, before we go on, what non-Star Trek thing have you been enjoying since we last spoke?
Charlie, you know how we always try and make a reference to the Mountain Goats on this podcast, but we never do because the Mountain Goats never really gets into a top 10 song to mention on the podcast. I have actually been re-listening to the three novels by Mountain Goats front person, John Darnielle.
Ooh.
Wolf and White Van, Universal Harvester, and Devil House, which I started yesterday.
Nice. I've got all three of them, but I've only read Universal Harvester so far, which I was recommending to someone just today. Yes, we are that much of white 40-year-old podcaster men. Of course I was talking about Mountain Goats and John Darnielle's novels with someone today.
Also, John Darnielle does read the audiobooks, so I feel he reads them really well, and he brings across like the style and the tone, and I just really enjoyed them. Both Wolf and White Fan and Universal Harvester have been books I've gone back and re-listened to every couple of years. This will be the second time I've listened to Devil House, because Devil House is a lot less punchier. I think it's about 10, 11 hours, where the other two are about 5, 6. But yeah, so Charlie, What non-Star Trek thing have you been enjoying?
So, just before the end of the year, I finally finished Mario Sunshine. A task which, admittedly, I was half-arsing for the back half of last year, but I finished that and New Super Mario Bros. On the DS, and this means I've been able to actually play the copy of Mario Galaxy I bought for the Switch 2 and then held off on playing because I knew it was imminent on the list, and bloody hell, it's a gorgeous game.
Yeah.
It's so much fun. I think I've got about 20 stars left to get before I reach the finale. Because, yeah, just pick it up, do a few stars, like, auto-saving and checkpointing kind of just naturally through a level, and like just the way the movement goes, you end up kind of craning your neck and trying to figure out, okay, which way is the ground, because it shifts so much. But the Switch 2, it's done a good job at mitigating any of the problems of it being a game that you'd play on a Wiimote and a nunchuck back in the day.
Oh man, we got the like Switch Virtual Console for N64. GoldenEye is nearly unplayable.
Yes.
Which is a shame, because GoldenEye is a fantastic game, but the N64 controller was special. Special.
Yeah. Yeah, I've got some fondness for it, but at the same time, bloody hell, it's a mess.
So I think I may have asked this off computer. So you've been replaying all the Mario games.
Yep.
When it came to Super Mario Bros. 2, did you play Super Mario Bros. 2 The Lost Levels, the original NES version, or did you play Super Mario Bros. 2 the reskin of Doki Doki Panic, where, you know, you can play as Princess Toadstool or Toad? Or Luigi?
The latter one, because okay. I figured I'd get very frustrated with Lost Levels. I've kind of made a bonus time list because it was last year's challenge, and I didn't complete it in a year. So I'm like, well, if I'm done with the others, I might actually try Lost Levels. But all I've heard about it is frustration. So, yeah. But what's hopefully not frustrating is our 3 episodes of Star Trek that we're watching. So, on to those. First of all, we have Star Trek The Next Generation, Season 5, Episode 19, which is called The First Duty. I handily had not written down the episode name here. So yes, it aired on the 30th of March 1992, written by Ronald Moore. Yes, that Ron Moore from the BSG. And Naran Shankar, directed by Paul Lynch. The UK number one hit at the time was Shakespeare's Sister with Stay, and the US had Vanessa Williams with Save the Best for Last. Now, my partner has seen a lot of Disney animated movies, has been showing me the Disney animated canon after finding out how few of them I've seen, and she was there when we were listening to these, and she was like, that is a bad Disney-ass movie song with Save the Best for Last. So yeah, it's a kind of straight-to-video sequel or sidequel kind of music track.
Oh man, we watched the Disney Hunchback of Notre Dame, which one of my personal favorites. Completely inaccurate to the book.
Of course.
My God, Tony J.S. Frollo is an amazing villain. And then there is the one song, which, you know how Disney villains seem to be very kind of cartoonishly, you know, Cruella de Vil, I want to murder these puppies for a nice coat. Yeah. Gaston, I just want to marry this girl. Frollo, meanwhile, his villain song is, I really want to have sex with this attractive woman. But if I do so, I'm worried that my soul is going to get condemned to hell. So the only natural course of action is to basically try and make her mine. And if I don't, I will burn down all of Paris. And Frollo, this is why you don't get invited to the Disney villain hangouts. Because yeah. Even Cruella de Vil, the lady who murders puppies for fun, would be like, yeah, no, get away from me.
Yeah, it's a bit much, really. He's gone a bit far. But yeah, and Shakespeare's Sister with Stay, great fun.
Yep.
It must be one of the first music videos I remember seeing on, like, Top of the Pops and those kind of things.
Man, I think the first music video I remember was the, I think it was Genesis. I can't remember the song, but I just remember it's like the, I can't dance, I can't sing.
Oh, yeah.
Or like one of the Michael Jacksons, because, like, you know, we're both kids of the 80s, so we would, yeah. Like, the Michael Jackson music videos were events.
Oh god, yeah. It's weird, a lot of these 1980s nostalgia TV shows and things, Michael Jackson doesn't seem to pop up a lot in those.
No,
Sorry, not a lot of people playing that music. Don't know why.
No, I mean, it's like you know, in the 90s when they never talk about the cultural cachet that was Jim Will Fix It, unless you're talking about the movie 28 Years Later or the forthcoming 28 Years Later, The Bone Temple.
Oh. Still not seen 28 Years Later.
Man, oh, you're missing out.
I know. I need to find it airing on anything, basically. But what I also need to do is, in 5 minutes, explain what Star Trek The First Duty is about.
Well, I'll tell you, well, for one thing, the first duty of every Starfleet officer is to the truth, be it personal truth, scientific truth, or recapping episodes of Star Trek. And if you can't recap it in 5 minutes, then you don't deserve to wear that uniform and engage.
So, this week, the planet of the week is Earth.
Ew.
Oh, JL. Earth. JL is going to give a commencement speech and hang out with his BFF, Wesley Crusher, catch up on the hot goss, braid each other's hair, have sleepovers, all that jazz. There's a problem, though. There's been an accident and Wesley's really burnt. He's alive, but badly burnt. I'm sorry about all those jokes just then about him. Oh, well. So JL tells Bev about this and she's got concerned, kind of like, concerned mumming, giving so much medical advice like she's the only doctor in the world. Once they both get to the academy, we find out a bit more. Wesley's one of four survivors out of a five-person flight. The casualty was one Joshua Albert, and there's barely anything of him or the ships left to salvage. There's going to be an inquest with Admiral Brand and her Vulcan sidekick with fascinating eyebrows, Sat Elk. The commencement is still going ahead, though, so they still need JL around. And he says the Enterprise will be at her disposal. Wes gets stretching his injured arm a bit when Bev and JL show up. And he's got a proper toy 1960s Enterprise, which is kind of cool. He's a little cagey about what went down. And then Tom Paris, Nicholas Locarno shows up. The inquiry's at 1500, but there's some suspicious music right now, which puts all of this into question, maybe. Nick was in charge of Nova Squad, a group of elite students who also were all in the crash. After Bev and JL leave, Nick says it'll be fine as long as they stick together, stick to the plan. Picard spots Boothby, an old gardener played by Glenn from the Stand TV movie. He knew Boothby as a student and thanks him for his help in vague ways, alluding to JL's roguish, wayward past. Boothby says he did what he thought was best and he knows all of the students around here. Nick inspects Nova Squadron and it's not just Wesley, the big nerd. There's also Hajar and Sito Jaxa. Yes, Wesley's now met multiple girls. At the inquest, Nick gives his report. Nova Squad did some flight stuff, then a collision. I couldn't remember it. I won't bore you with it. Hajar's called up and made the flight plan. Did they deviate? No. Well, yeah, a little bit, but not significantly. Sito's asked if she saw anything, and no, there wasn't visual contact, because they were just using sensors. And there's some mumbling as, ooh, that's not normal. Nick takes over and says Josh was erratic, nervous. He wanted to give Josh a break, damn it, which is why he didn't report it. Josh's dad is in the audience and he gives very good sad dad face.
Oh.
He is unhappy about all of this. His son is taking all of the blame. Oh, they're out of time though, so they'll grill Wesley tomorrow. Now Picard decides to help and get the engineering boys down to have a bit of a look over things. Sito's upset about Nick. Wes is upset because they're Starfleet and they don't lie. He also gets told they're not lying, they're just not telling truths. So yeah, that's fine. Nick's basically love bombing a lot of them, saying how proud he is of them. How, you know, aren't they all just so great? And Wesley, being Wesley, goes over all the flight data on his own when Mr. Albert comes in. And he apologizes for Josh letting Wes down. And oh, my lovelies, oh, my dears, how much that stings at the poor boy's heart. At the deposition, we see Wes's camera for the first part of the flight, and then it cuts out. and he describes a Jaeger loop, basically a flippy thing. Then there's a collision, then they transport it out. Satelk isn't sure about this and grills Wes, because apparently a nearby satellite had some images of it, and it contradicts their events. What do you say about that, Wesley Crusher? Nothing. Yeah, nothing. They have a recess, and outside, Bev says, obviously the satellite is wrong. Her perfect boy wouldn't do anything bad. So Data and LaForge are going to look into that. Oh, Wes doesn't like that either. Picard chats with Boothby, who's pulling up some weeds, and mentions how Nova Squad are hot shots. Everyone's proud of them, and the squad would do anything for one Nicholas Locarno. Data and LaForge have, of course, found nothing wrong with the satellite, but it looks like the kids were doing maybe some kind of engine check and purging plasma. And then it ignited. Oh! Boom! Just like this recap.
There's so much the boy in this episode.
There is a lot of the boy.
The boy. He never calls him the boy, but it's always subtextual.
It is.
I am going to start the timer, and you can finish your deposition.
Okay. All right, Your Honor. So, JL speaks to Wes and asks him about the maneuver that happened, the culvert maneuver. Apparently it's been banned for 100 years after all of the 5 students that tried it died, basically doing a flippy roundy star-shaped thing using a lot of plasma. Sounds a bit bad. Now, JL reckons that Locarno pressured them all into doing it as a showstopper. Wes chooses not to answer, and oh my, Dad's mad now! A lie of omission is still a lie, Wesley. He has to come out with the truth, or JL's going to do it for him. Oh, the stress. Wesley calls Nick in, and he says, no one's going to believe Picard. Somehow, the captain of the flagship. Sure, Nick's just really pissed off. He doesn't like an outside factor controlling his destiny, and says Wesley's betraying his friends. At the inquiry, Brand can't reconcile all of these details. There are too many contradictions. So she's going to close it down with reprimands for all of the survivors of Nova Squad. But then Wesley speaks up. He mentions that they did the loop and then they did the culvert maneuver, and that's when it went wrong. They'd pushed and bullied Josh into it, and he wasn't ready, but no one wanted to let Nick down. Brand asks Nick to speak, and ooh, he says nothing in a guilty way. Then we cut to the gardens with JL and Wes. Locarno's been expelled and pled to have the others spared. Wesley will pay. He's going to lose his last year of academic progress, and everyone's going to know he's a bit shit. Wesley thanks him for the guidance, and JL says he knows what to do. Picard just reminded him. The end.
Right. 1 minute, 54 seconds. So, do you think that now he has a reputation of a bit of a sexy bad boy, Wes pulled like crazy when retaking his next year at Starfleet Academy?
No, it's still Wes. Like, as a man that came from the bad boy school in Brighton, that didn't make me cooler. I was never cool. Like, none of this helps. It just, yeah, I assume people had stop copying off his homework or something.
I just have one thing to say about Nick Locarno.
Oh yeah.
And to quote Mariner in the season 4 finale of Lower Decks, this guy sucks.
He really does suck, doesn't he?
Like, God, he's the worst.
God, he's looking into him, obviously, and the real world reason why he didn't, like, Robert Duncan McNeil wasn't Locarno in Voyager is because they didn't want to pay Ron Moore residuals or anything for having created Nick Locarno. But even with that, McNeil was saying that actually these are quite different people, because while Tom Paris is a bit of a shit, he's still actually got a decent heart, where Locarno externally seems nice and pleasant and is just a real piece of work.
I think Locarno is what Paris thinks he is.
Mm.
Paris is definitely like a Wolverine kind of, yeah, I don't stick my neck out for no one or no man. I'm just in it for number one. I ain't in this for your revolution. When he's in it for the revolution, he just claims he's not. He's Jeff He's Jeff Winger.
Yeah, a good point of comparison there. But yeah, he's Wes falling in with a bad crowd. I mean, we hear nothing about any of the others, but you know, no smoke without fire.
Yeah.
I mean, that said, one of them apparently will appear again in the Lower Decks episode. The TNG episode that is Lower Decks.
And I think one of them, the same one who died in the Lower Decks, in the Lower Decks episode TNG, was meant to be a classmate of Mariner's.
Oh.
Because there is a cameo of her at Starfleet Academy when they're all planning to do the Culvert Starburst maneuver. Because we have Nick Locano turning up in season 4 and hasn't learned a goddamn thing.
No.
And gets killed by a paywall.
Hooray! Yeah, I thought this was a fun episode. It's weird to go after all the mocking of Wesley early on. It's quite nice seeing him actually developing as a student, even if he is succumbing to peer pressure.
And I think Will Wheaton said that this is one of his personal favorite episodes that he worked on. And it's like, yeah. After God knows how many seasons of him being the boy who can do nothing wrong and is just perfect at every point, it's nice to see that he's clearly burning out at Starfleet Academy.
Well, yeah, thing is, he's never met other kids.
No.
You know, it is that same problem with Kitty Pryde when she meets the New Mutants of like, but these aren't my people. Like this overachiever who, yeah, like he hasn't got it right. He has tried being with the elite cool kids and it's really backfired. It's good fun. Also seeing Boothby and seeing the academy, which distractingly was the same gardens where Wesley ran on the grass and got sentenced to death in Justice.
Oh, Planet Fuck.
Planet Fuck, yes. I don't know if Starfleet Academy modelled its gardens on Planet Fuck or the other way around, but someone did.
Just Wesley came in and said, excuse me, you know what makes this work? More botanical gardens.
Damn straight. And these ones you can run on the grass for. Take that, Planet Fuckians.
I got the implication that the reason why Boofy's having to redo so many flowers is because these horny Starfleet Academy students are just fucking on his prized begonias every night.
I mean, I wouldn't be surprised.
No, as we can kind of tell from what we get from Starfleet, what we've heard about people's histories at Starfleet Academy, you are either like this super swotty nerd who is a book on legs, like James T. Kirk, or you're like you're a swaggering, sexy bad boy who's clearly getting a drink and getting into fights, like
Picard. Yeah. I still love that about the two of them.
Do you know who wasn't in this episode a lot?
Well, most of them.
Wes's mum.
Yeah! Like, she was there at the start, doing a lot of the mumming, and she was there kind of like as JL's hype man, kind of helping back him up a bit, but not really interacting much. Like, the dad, what is it? Mr. Albert Sr., whatever, he got more screen time
Oh, man, and every time it just panned back to him, it just, he nailed it perfectly. Like, he looked like he was either about to start crying or throwing down.
Yeah, this was a man that was visibly on the worst day of his life. And I'm like, how is he looking sadder than he did minutes ago, where he looked like the saddest man in the world? It was incredible, like, kudos to Ed Lauter, who played him. It was a stunning performance. Similarly, Richard Fancy, who played Satelk, like, he's one of those actors you see in stuff. Like, I definitely recognize him from Seinfeld. But yeah, he gave the proper good, like, inquest antagonist sort of thing there of like, oh, Wesley, no. We know this is bullshit kind of thing, but you know, in Vulcan.
But yeah, and like, I think also this episode is a really good inversion of, it's an inversion of the Wes does something amazing shtick, which was Wesley's shtick all the time. Yeah. But here it's just like, yeah, Wesley attempts to do something perfect, and for once it backfires, and he has to deal with the consequences. And the consequences is he got a friend killed, and now he's lying about it.
Yeah, God. And then pretty much having to repeat a year. So yeah, it's a rough time for Wes.
I mean, you say that repeating a year is what turned Arnold Judas Rimmer into the man, the myth, the legend of Ace Rimmer in an alternate universe.
True, but that doesn't happen to Wes here, does it?
No.
Alas.
Oh man, if like when Wes came back in the game and he was like, he had like the swaggering Ace Rimmer hair and the aviator shades and just walked in like the coolest guy, like cooler than Riker somehow.
Oh, that'd be amazing. Yeah, then he'd have game. But yes, so I think especially after a bit of a break of us doing this, I was watching this and just thinking, that's Star Trek. It's pretty good, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like,
I was totally distracted by a regular door handle on Wesley's dorm room. Like when Nick turned it, I stopped. I rewound. It's like, wait. No, that's weird.
Like, there's not even a lock.
No.
Like, my rooms at uni had locks.
I mean, they should.
Yeah. I think the reason why why Josh went down was like they all just snuck into his room late at night and just kind of did the beat him with like a bar of soap and a sock, like in Full Metal Jacket.
God, just like you will do for Covert Maneuver. We believe in you, bye. Like, we're, Nick couldn't do that, of course, because he's got to be positive about
we're
it.
We're doing this because we love you.
Exactly.
And you got Wesley, who's just got the sock, thinking, Picard never did this to me. Picard never did this to me as a gesture of love. The boy.
Oh, that boy.
Oh, man. Picard gives his fantastic speech in his meeting room, and Wesley goes, yep, nope, I plead the fifth. You can tell Picard wants to now just go full Homer Simpson on Wesley Crusher for the first time.
I literally went, oh, no, Wes! Just like, Picard's whole thing, and we knew in the pilot, in the first season, he's like, oh, I can't deal with children. Oh, all that. But him recounting it from his perspective, going, but I kept my eye on you. Like, you knew shit. Like, there's a reason you're up here, you precocious child, instead of anyone else's kid. Like, for all you know, most of the bridge personnel here have children who are not allowed on here. But they know nothing. Worf's child, when he comes along, he ain't getting on this bridge for shit. But, and for Wes to take all that and go, I ain't saying nothing, Dad.
That's because, you know, Worf would never let Alexander anywhere near the bridge.
It wouldn't be
like Wesley just kind of sneaks into the turbo lift with Crusher. I get the feeling that just Worf, just anytime Worf has to go to work, he just leaves Alex to a cupboard and gives him a colouring book.
So, Worf, we have schools here. We have places you can put a child. He is fine now.
I do not think the other animals would appreciate him in the kennels.
Oh. No wonder he went evil in that comic.
Like, you feel sorry for Alex.
Yeah. God. So, with all that in mind, we're pretty positive about this, and we should probably put it on a big list of different Star Trek episodes and movies.
From best to worst.
Yeah, exactly that. So, we have a big list currently standing at 187 entries. That is a shocking amount. That is currently almost 20% of all Star Trek.
Jesus.
Yeah. Now, they do keep making more of it, so that will slide, but that's an impressive amount. in our number one spot, we have Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, because of course we do. In spot number 100, we have the slightly less dignified title of I Excretus from Lower Decks. And then all the way down the very, very bottom, we have Star Trek Section 31, where it belongs, in the bin. I did my duty as well by making sure another couple of people did not see it after going, yeah, I should get round to that. No.
I've been writing up my 2025 year blog, and for movies I watched that year, it gets an honorable mention of just like a movie I watched purely out of contractual obligation.
Yes. So where do we want to put the first duty?
Okay, I noticed while going through the list that the game was actually earlier in the season.
Oh, wow.
At like season 5, episode 9.
Oh, God, yeah. Yeah, so he must have been on holiday or just briefly away or transported somewhere. I forget.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
You know, it's typical of Wesley. He goes home for his Easter vacays and saves the ship from like a bunch of aliens trying to take it over. That's the typical Wesley Crusher shenanigans he gets up to. So yeah, I completely buy that Wesley would have thought, yeah, we could pull this off.
Yeah, definitely. You know, he's a like space genius.
All right. Okay. How?
So I think this is better than the game, as enjoyable as the game was.
I mean, the game does give us Wesley Crusher's O face.
Whereas, I'd forgotten about that.
Where this gives us Wesley Crusher's oh, why is sad face.
Oh.
Okay. The game is at 121. I am looking up a few more. Okay. At number 91, we've got Prodigy's season 1, episodes 9 and 10, A Moral Star, where the Prodigy kids quite literally go and do a Starfleet.
God, yeah. Oh, that was good.
And I feel this is definitely they don't go and do a Starfleet.
No. This is what happens when a Starfleet is not done.
Definitely.
Yeah. I think Moral Star is good. I think this is probably better. This is a proper
drama of people standing in rooms, delivering two-handers.
Oh, God, like, yeah.
We've got no big space action. Like, it's one of those episodes of Star Trek that you could just do as a stage play and would still work.
Yeah. Like, Ron Moore loves these, as we'll find out imminently as well in DS9. But, yeah, let's see. We've got the Wounded at 78, where O'Brien has to deal with his old captain.
Okay, I think I might be, you know how when we get like good episodes of Voyager and Enterprise, we do tend to rank them higher. I feel like there is a worry that with this episode, we might be doing this because it's a good episode, like a legitimately good episode with the boy.
Yeah.
With Wesley Crusher and Will Wheaton actually getting to act and not just be like a bit of a SWAT, shall we say.
Okay, so I get what you mean, caution-wise. Like, a couple of spots above The Wounded, 76, we've got The Naked Time, and I think that beats this.
Yeah.
With everyone getting space drunk.
Below that, we have the Discovery two-part season opener, The Vulcan Hello and Battle at the Binary Stars.
Yeah.
Which, fantastic, fantastic visuals, but I think in terms of drama, is a bit empty in comparison. But at the same time, you have that thing, with Discovery, you have that you're bringing back Star Trek for a modern audience. You want to capture a mainstream audience. So you're going to give something big and flashy because you can afford to do it as well. Whereas this is like, this is coming up on like on next gen, like last couple of seasons. But at this point, once the ensemble hits, it hits.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. Like, in a way, if the Vulcan Hello wasn't the pilot, you could see some really good two-hander courtroom drama kind of stuff going on with Michael Burnham and what she did. But yeah, it's a what? Below Naked Time, above Vulcan Hello?
Yeah, that's what I have to say.
Yeah, 77 there. Excellent. So, that is our first one of the evening. Right, so our second episode is Star Trek Deep Space Nine, Season 6, Episode 22, titled Valiant. God, I remember when shows used to get 22 episodes or more. I used to loathe that sometimes and go, oh, that's too many, especially if it was like Flash. And now I kind of miss a longer season. This aired on the 6th of May, 1998, written once again by Ron Moore and directed by Michael Vija. I assume pronounced like Vija, not sure. The UK number one hit was All Saints with Lady Marmalade. No, not the one from Moulin Rouge, the one from 1998's film Doctor Dolittle. And yeah, then the US next with Too Close. Man, these are not great.
No.
No. Like, I like All Saints. And no, this is not good.
And I've got nothing.
Yeah. Yeah, I didn't know what next was. And then my partner and I were looking up the lyrics while it was playing. And it's basically about dancing too close to a woman at a club and popping a boner. And then kind of still grinding a bit.
Okay. I'm sorry. You made that up.
No,
that doesn't sound like an actual song. It sounds like a 5-minute Quentin Tarantino monologue where he tries to make you believe that this is what the song's actually about.
It's like, this isn't even the geniuses at genius.com inevitably misinterpreting a song. This is the literal lyrics.
God.
Yeah, so on that note, Miles, I believe you're recapping this episode rather than Too Close by Next.
Fantastic. Thankfully, the only boner popped in this episode is for Captain Waters.
Wow. So on that note, you have 5 minutes. Otherwise, we may have to lose you in the Gamma Quadrant for, what is it, 8 months?
Dominion Space.
Dominion Space. Oh, God, yeah, because they're over here now. Yeah. As well. I say here. They're not in Brighton.
No.
No. So, 5 minutes starting now.
Is Quark in love with Dax? Odo seems to think so, and he's enjoying that. But, you know, enough of that. It's never going to get brought up again in this episode. Nog and Jake are on a trip to Ferenginar. Nog has a special diplomatic message for the Grand Nagus, and Jake, who is occasionally a reporter, thinks it's an offer for a diplomatic alliance between the Federation and the Ferengi. Nog tells him to leave it out. Meanwhile, Jake is like, come on, it's boys' trip to Ferenginar. I've always wanted to see the rain and the mud. But en route, the space station they just left gets attacked by a collection of Jem'Hadar fighters. They flee, but one pursues them. Credits! The runabout is being pushed deeper and deeper into Dominion space. Nog drops out of warp and tries to fight off the Dominion. The runabout is heavily damaged, and Jake is wounded by a Star Trek exploding console. How do we know he's a main character? Because he's okay afterwards. But then suddenly, a new Defiant-class ship arrives to save the day, and Jake and Nog are beamed on board. The ship is the Valiant, and the crew is entirely made of cadets, most particularly Red Squad, an elite academy crew led by Tim Waters, they were all put on this ship as part of a training mission. War broke out, and they were caught behind enemy lines. And when the captain and all the adult crew were killed, Tim got a battlefield commission to captain, and he used that opportunity to promote others. So for the last 5-8 months, they have been doing the best they can to kind of take the fight to the Dominion. But they can't really go too far. The ship has a lot of problems. Nog wants to help. And he is made chief engineer so they can fix the warp drives, because they're collecting material on a new type of Dominion warship. But there is an issue. When Jake pushes, it turns out Starfleet doesn't know that the cadet Waters is in command. Jake smells a rat immediately, and Nog just immediately starts guzzling Kool-Aid by the jug. Oh yeah. Jake is shown around the ship by Collins, who is a lunar resident, and they talk about home and pretty much how much Collins misses it, which causes her to have a little bit of a cry. Later on, Nog is able to work on fixing the warp core based on what he knows that O'Brien had to do to fix the Defiant warp core when they brought the Defiant to DS9. Jake is brought to the command crew and berated by Waters and Faris, who is literally called Karen, have a talk with him about Wesley lowering morality. You see, the thing is, while everyone is eager to kind of treat Nog as one of their own, Jake, who has specifically chosen not to join Starfleet, is kind of treated as a persona non grata by the majority of the crew. Waters tries to appeal to Jake as a journalist and to stay away from getting involved in the story. Meanwhile, once Jake is gone, Waters confides to Faris that he's not been sleeping, secretly popping pills to stay awake. So, with the warp core fixed, they're now going to go and take on this new Dominion warship. There is a particular weakness to the warship based on the materials used, and they think they can construct a special kind of torpedo which will turn the ship into wet pasta. It's a metaphor. But the thing is, because of the way they have to reconfigure the missile, they basically have to kind of do a 2-meter bullseye womp rats and a T-16 back home really close, otherwise it's not going to work. Waters gets the crew together, and he gives a big speech about how they could just go home, but wouldn't it be better for them to stay here and finish the fight, like at the end of Halo 2? Jake calls BS immediately, and has an argument with Nog, because Nog is all in on getting out there and finishing the fight. Nog never finished his training at Starfleet Academy. He was kind of battlefield posted when war broke out between like seasons 5 or 6. And so he accuses Jake of not getting it. Jake is thrown in the brig, and the Valiant crew prepares to do their big attack. And the attack goes just as well as you can imagine, i.e. poorly, because they have a plan, but the moment the plan falls apart, when the torpedo doesn't work, Captain Waters completely goes all to pieces. The ship is bombarded with Dominion shots, and most of the crew are killed.
Speaking of all shot up, so is this time. Well, I've no idea what that even means. So let's just press on.
The entire crew of the Valiant is killed, except for Nog, Jake, and Collins, who managed to make it out in the escape pods, which aren't blown up by the Dominion as they escape. They are picked up by the Defiant and a proper crew, and everyone is fine. Jake's a bit shooken up, Nog's very shooken up, and Collins is traumatized. Nog asks Jake if he's going to write the story for the Federation News Service, and Jake's like, yeah, I will. And Nog says, hey, you know, how are you going to frame it? Because I think the best way you can do it is let the readers decide for themselves. It was a good ship. It was a good crew. But the captain failed them. And Collins is like, no, if anything, we failed Captain Tim Waters. And Nog's like, no, he may have been a great man. He may have been a hero, but he was a bad captain.
Yeah, he was. That is 57 seconds over. Yeah, so, God, this... So many kids dead.
A lot of dead kids.
I've seen this one before, and I vaguely remembered it did not go well. I forgot how not well it went. And man, yeah. That was like early on, you start looking at them, and obviously Paul Popovich, a guy who plays Waters, is a bit older and seems kind of a bit more mature than the others. But the moment you see some of the others, like Karen, it's like, oh God, that's a literal child. That was shocking. But yeah, like, you also get a little bit of the kind of like, okay, this is a young actor, like Ashley Brianne McDonough, who plays Collins. She's fine. She isn't the best, but acting chops wise, like, she gets the job done, really. But yeah, and actually, I thought I recognized Waters, and he was in Degrassi.
Of course he was.
He wasn't a student, though. He played a reporter who kind of sexually assaulted one of the kids that was interning for the paper.
Okay.
Yep. Yeah, nothing good happens there.
I wish they had done a bit more with of basically, you know, where Jake is the outside, and is the outside, and whereas they all know who his father is, they clearly have no patience for Jake. Like, they buried that very kind of that mindset of you don't serve, so therefore you don't understand.
God, there really is that mentality here. The like, I loved how coolly Jake's like, yeah, you all know who my dad is. So like, yeah, he's not even doing it. Don't you know who I am? It's like, no. Like, I'm Cisco's kid. But yeah, that kind of immediate disrespect and cliquiness. And like, poor Nog immediately going, oh my God, I've got approval. I can be a serious person. And like, one of the things I saw online was Ron Moore defending the fact that as far as military ranks go, technically Nog would outrank Waters.
I did wonder that, because he's technically an officer at this point.
Yes. Yeah. Compared to Waters. But to be honest, I think the peer pressure alone would, like, this is Nog. He would immediately crack for peer pressure and be like, yes, right, okay, I've got some legitimacy, I'm on board. And sadly, that does mean leaving behind his BFF.
Definitely with Nog, you know, you can tell he kind of, especially when he becomes a cadet, he goes all in on being a member of Starfleet.
Yeah, like, not in the same way that Wes does, which is quite nice that it can be handled in a different style. And in a way,
it's the same way. The character I think is most similar to Nog is Worf. Because Worf has spent his entire life being raised by humans and living in a human world. So he goes very much all in on embracing his Klingon heritage. Whereas Rom, who is a Ferengi and realizes he has no place where that society would legitimize him, instead throws his lot in with Starfleet and goes all in on being a Starfleet officer.
Yeah, and it's fun. Once again, it's that odd thing of going, it's kind of fun seeing these two who mostly interact with adults. It's nice that they have each other, but now they're having to be around kids, and these kids are thinking they're adults, where, you know, Jake knows they're not, he isn't. And yeah, it's it is tragic what goes on, and they did some great things. And you hit that point where it's like, Waters going, well, we've got this information, we've done amazing things, we could turn back,
but
and you can feel from several of the people there, they would have loved to have gone home. Like, he has got them killed because of this grandstanding.
At no point does he put it to a vote.
No.
Or anything. Okay, so I have a question for you.
Yeah.
Do you think Waters was actually given a battlefield command commission by the captain, or did he just say that because he saw an opportunity and took it?
I hadn't even thought of that.
I'll be honest, given the way his personality works throughout the story, I wouldn't have been surprised if it had turned out that he saw a chance to make his name, to make his reputation, and just went with it.
one thing is it entirely wrong to go, all the adults are dead. If I just say that I've been given this commission, someone is in charge. They're not going to fall to hell.
There has to be a pecking order.
Exactly.
What this episode actually reminds me of is the original Mobile Suit Gundam series, where the Federation crew of the White Base, which is the main ship of the show, where the main cast is situated, is mostly comprised of a few military officers who are either cadets or have just left cadet training, and civilians who have unfortunately been drafted into a war which has killed off all the most of the adults. And one of my favorite parts of that show is the push and pull between people who just know how the military structure works because they've learned it in a book, and how they have to work with civilians who don't know the book and want to try and do their own thing. And you see that push, and it's not just the push and pull, it's also seeing the both sides come together as the times through the show and the battles they experience makes them into a sort of found family where the command structure is there, but there is also Bright Noah, the captain of the ship, even though he's 19 but perpetually 37, comes to realize that this annoying 15-year-old with social anxiety issues might have a few points when knowing how best to use robots, because he's the one who goes out every robot mission.
Yeah, and that thing of someone who isn't really prepared, isn't really psychologically ready for war. And these are kids that are playing at war.
Yeah, they think it's a great adventure. Like, another thing this reminds me of is a joke in the novel Slaughterhouse-5, where in the scenes of the book, which is set in World War II before Billy Pilgrim gets captured, he is stuck with these three soldiers, and there is this one soldier who in his head sees himself, and the two other soldiers as the Three Musketeers, and this annoying chaplain who they're stuck with, and he wants to just be going on. He just wants to be, hey, we're the Three Musketeers, and when they get rescued, he's like, yeah, we just like serve the rest of the world together because we're the Three Musketeers. And then the moment he says that, when the other two soldiers are like, yeah, we're gonna try and get ourselves captured and get put in a POW camp, he's like, but no, what about the Three Musketeers, guys? And they're just like, what the fuck are you talking about, mate?
Yeah,
it is just that kind of, it's how you survive or go mad.
Yeah, and it's good that they have survived this long, behind enemy lines. They've done all these things, and yeah, that's like, they would be heroes if they came back without any information. They'd be heroes if they came back just with the information.
Yeah. They would be heroes if they didn't treat it as, if the captain didn't clearly treat it as a, did you, okay, when you first, when you see Walter sitting in the chair, did you see him trying to do a Kirk? It felt like he was trying to do that kind of Kirk kind of slouch.
Yeah, it did feel like that kind of, yeah, I'm playing it cool on this seat kind of thing. That definite sort of vibe again of playing at captain,
yes,
much like playing at war, and through virtual screens, through a distance and not having to do anything close up, they didn't have to actually confront real horrors of war. They didn't have to deal with any of that,
or they just have the mindset of, we're the good guys.
Yeah,
when we pull off the daring plan, it's going to work. Because this is how it always works in Star Trek.
Yeah.
When Kirk or Sisko or Picard has the cockamamie scheme that's not going to work, they'll make it work.
Definitely. Yeah. So, it was good fun, a tragedy. And it, again, I think one of my main notes was, Ron Moore loves doing these. Like, he will do this kind of thing in Battlestar Galactica numerous times as well.
Ron Moore just loves killing kids.
Well, he loves his military drama, you know, and playing with all of this. Like, this is before he got, I mean, I don't know how disillusioned he was by season six, but, you know, he is still doing well here. Like, he's still doing some great stuff.
Then also you have to think like this, that with the human members of the Federation, that this is these are kids who have been who have grown up in a world without war.
Mm.
And so, yeah, I would see that these kids would just kind of treat it as a game.
Yeah.
Because it's still a game and not, like, not the actual cost of war, which is blood, tears, and human life.
Oh, dear. Well, yeah, I don't know if anything ever came of Collins after this, or in any kind of apocrypha. I don't think so. But yeah, like, her at the end of this going, no, we failed him. So, oh no. Oh dear, that's...
Like,
yeah.
It's not... He's become a Kurtz, but he's not... But he's like, he's not like... He's a nice Kurtz. Again, it's the love bombing.
Yeah, yeah, it's that peer pressure, that kind of... Yeah, we've sided with the right guy. He is, I mean, he's slightly less like Locarno in going, I believe in all of you. You know, he's a bit more kind of using command for it and promoting people as he needs to. So you're going to want to please him to get a battlefield promotion.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, it didn't sound like everyone was going to be getting that.
No, and it's very much like there is the people in command who treat the cadets as stupid kids.
Yeah.
Because you have Karen who's like, oh, we can't have the children worried about mummy and daddy back home. It's like, no, I think you can.
Yeah. How shit's your home life?
Yeah.
You know? But yeah, just preemptively hitting that Karen nominative determinism there. So, with Valiant on our big list, I guess a good starting point is better or worse than our previous episode.
Ooh, I would say in some ways this is better, and in some ways this is worse, because you never really get to see most of the crew, and so you never get to, you know, and you just kind of you take their word for it that everything was going hunky dory until Jake and Nog arrived. But it's still a story leading up. It's still a fantastic story leading up to a heartbreaking conclusion.
Yeah.
Like the moment, like, all the explosions settle and the Dominion ship is this unaffected, turned towards them. It's like, we are fucked.
Oh God. Yeah. The moment that happens, it's like, yeah, they are not equipped for this.
No.
Like, as far as experience, as far as just emotions, anything. I think, like, you get a good glimpse of the perspectives of people of going, yeah, Collins did not want this.
Yeah.
Like, she is doing her best despite how bad things are. That kind of thing. Yeah, compared to Karen, who is just has evidently been waiting for this moment.
Mm.
You know, like, at school, I don't know about you, but in some cliques you would often see that gleeful second in command that would be kind of tailing around the person in charge, desperate to have any level of authority.
So, oof. I mean, what do you think?
It's difficult. Like, this has the better, like, action drama stuff. It's got some great roles for Nog and for Jake to play. There is something quite nice about the simplicity of the first duty. Mm. By comparison, these two are both good actors already, but getting to see the boy do something positive as well, yeah, quite nice.
All right, so okay, 86, Enterprise season 2, episode 2, Carbon Creek.
That's a good one. It is. I mean, that said, it is a very good episode of Enterprise. It's a good episode of science fiction, where this feels like, yeah, a very Star Trek thing.
Yes.
You know, even though it's out of the environment, you know, Star Trek doesn't often do war stuff.
No.
And it certainly doesn't kill this many kids normally.
Okay, so then after that, at number 87, we've got Lower Decks' Two Vixes.
Hmm.
Where we find out in no uncertain terms that Janeway was right.
Yep, of course. I feel like that needs to be a thing. Kind of like the old Cyclops was right and Magneto made some valid points.
Okay, then below that at 88, we have Deep Space Nine's The Forsaken, where Luxana Troi wants to take a swim in Odo.
I think this is better than that.
Yeah, that works for me, because after that was Genesis.
Oh, yeah.
Where Worf definitely killed an Aether guy.
I still love Genesis. But yeah.
Yep, Genesis is dumb.
It is. It is very much dumb in the most complimentary way.
Yes.
Excellent. So that makes this, what, the new 88.
Okay. Works for me.
Lovely. So, episode 3 is Star Trek Discovery Season 4, Episode 4, titled All Is Possible. This aired on the 9th of December 2021, written by Alan McElroy, no, not one of those McElroys, and Eric J. Robbins, directed by John Ottman. The UK number one hit was Slade with Merry Xmas, Everybody, and the US had a bit more of a depressing time with Adele and Easy on Me, which, yeah, it feels a bit retro and backward looking with Slade there for the UK, but Easy on Me does make me feel like, and I know the answer's no, but going, are you all right, mate, to the US? which, no, as it turns out, they weren't, and would continue not to be for some time.
I mean, all I do thankful for, I do not work in a job any longer where I have to listen to the poppy Christmas music.
Hey, that's good.
Progress.
Yes. So, yeah, I guess I'll have to tell the good people what this is all about. As our kind of the closest we've got to a backdoor pilot, the imminent Starfleet Academy.
All right, and begin.
So, the Discovery's in the grim dark future. Book. His homeworld has been destroyed by something called the DMA, and a Romulan nun ninja did a murder. So, things are a bit weird, but Discovery's at Nivar trying to look into the DMA, and damn it, these Taipei overachieving nerds need downtime, but it's so difficult for them all to chill out, because they're all too intense. Oh dear. Sarah and Burnham are going to have to sit in on the Federation talks with Nivar about them rejoining the Federation, as they're covering for an ambassador who's suddenly and conspicuously unwell. Tilly talks with Cobra, who's in therapy mode for now, and she's been looking at taking some time out from her desperate sprint for Captain's chair. He says that Dr. Kovic wants someone to look after some new Starfleet Academy cadets, and she'll do fine. Also, Cobra talks to Book about mourning his homeworld. We'll get this one over with quickly. So, Book's resistant to doing his own world's mourning rituals, and is introduced to a few others and some nice anecdotes from Culber. Maybe he'll get there, but at least in the meantime he's made a nice mandala. Next up, we'll get the peace talks done. So, President Laura Rilax there from the Federation and President Tarina from Nivar both have their own internal political reasons not to compromise in their stances, which are the Federation wants the Vulcans and Romulans back in, and Nivar wants a free exit clause, which would be a massive problem if everyone follows suit. It basically depowers the whole thing. So Michael chats with Relak and Saru chats with Tarina, who's also interested in more than just his political prowess, if you know what I mean. They figure out that neither side can actually budge, but they can compromise with a third party. They're going to set up a council of not just Nivar, but all worlds to make sure they're all still cool. And Michael, of course, has to insert herself into everything. So she's going to represent Nivar and Starfleet as a citizen of both communities. So, on to the Academy stuff. Tilly's got Adira Tal to join her, and Adira stresses about it to Gray, who's a bit more chill about hanging out alone on Discovery. Kovic introduces Tilly and Adira to the students, and Adira is sent off to stand by them and doesn't seem to be aware that they were there as a student as well. The kids are Callum, the doomed one, Val Sasha, the girl one, Harold, the green one, and Gorev, who is a Tellarite. They fly out towards the moon, but things go wrong. Tilly's trying too hard in trying to get them to do icebreakers, as they've been isolated for all their use and aren't used to interacting with other people. Then, after she has her go, the shuttle goes wrong. They crash. Oh no, Callum's dead. And when they open the shutters, they're on an icy moon with thousands of life forms making up one giant tentacle monster banging against the window. Harold assumes all of this is just a holodeck program because apparently he's not done any practical things at all. It's all been hologram work. He gets in an argument with Gorev. Tilly splits him up and restarts the icebreakers. Adira starts by saying they were from a generation ship and are an ensign already. Sasha's from Titan Colony, which we've had previous with in this season, and was a pilot from age 12. Gorev's family were caught up in a lot of Emerald Chain nastiness. And, of course, Harold and Orion says he has to work real hard to be top of the class, given everyone's attitude about Orion people, what with the aforementioned whole, you know, Emerald Chain stuff. Anyway, the shuttle's fucked. There are 46 moons around here, 3 days of rations. It's going to be a real problem getting found. So, the thing outside, it senses energy signals. So, they need to power down. It goes away. They go to a near... Well, they aim to go to a nearby ridge and send for backup using a comm badge's signal instead. Tal and Harold both offer to go by themselves, but Tilly says they have to live together or die alone. So they trudge through the snow and the spider lightning, which the thing apparently. A creature pops up out in the distance. No, there's two of them. They disappear back down under the ice, hunting for any tasty, tasty energy. Harold suggests why not ride out the storm in a cave and is clowned on by the others. Let's face it, this doesn't look like a storm that's ending. Tilly is annoyed at all of the kids and Adira's trapped by some fast-growing ice. The creatures are getting closer to them. Tilly throws them a rope and Adira's pulled free. Oh, I'm not though. Oh.
Right, get back on the ice.
Oh, damn. Oh, it's so cold here. So, yes, Gorev says, why not just leave Harold in a cave? And Tilly wants them both to get past their goddamn baggage. Adira mentions that they know who Harold's dad is, an Orion activist who helped to emancipate slaves. Take that, Gorev! And Sasha also catches some strays for shooting down the whole cave thing as well. Let's go! They say yes, but they're Starfleet, so they're told... That should be I, and they all enthusiastically do an I. Thank you. They reach the top of the ledge, and the new challenge is that they need to distract these creatures for 60 whole seconds so their transmission will get picked up. Adira and Harold once again reckon they'll do it, but no, Tilly's going to show these kids how it's done, because let's face it, if she's dead, she won't have to deal with them anymore. She draws the attention of the creatures and flees while everyone fires phasers at them. Eventually, the kids are beamed out and Tilly, a few seconds later, just for dramatic tension. Back at Starfleet Academy, Kovic goes over what happened. It's a bit of a tragedy with Callum and all that, but it's amazing anyone survived. Says that folks here in the grimdark future were a bit put out when Discovery showed up and kept acting like anything's possible, but maybe... Just maybe that's what the Academy needs. Adira is happy that they got friends, and despite everything, you know, approaching everything in a sort of doomed way, Tilly and Grey remind them that all is possible. Ooh, that's the title of the episode. Tilly, on the other hand, meets up with Burnham, explains actually she's not going to stay here on Discovery, she's going to the Academy. She's going to be a teacher, perhaps in about 4, maybe 5 years time, television time wise. She'll be around occasionally in this show, but she's going to set her own course. And there's a bit of a nice montage as she leaves. Aww.
That's 2 minutes and 4 seconds.
Yeah, I remember watching this back in the day and feeling like, oh no, but I like Tilly. Oh, it was a shame to lose her from this show, but it was kind of, it was fun seeing them think about, oh shit, if we're actually serious about being Starfleet, we kind of need new people. We need a Starfleet Academy. Yeah, and it's a bit, I guess it's one of those things of you'd expect them to also allow adults at this time, because they have so few people in Starfleet, but you know, this is something. So yeah, what did you think of this?
I mean, it's difficult because I've actually not, most of the season 4 or 5 episodes of Discovery, I've only had, this is my first time watching it. Oh. So a lot of the wider arc stuff, I'm still kind of lost on. Yeah.
Yeah. Luckily, Book and the DMA don't take too much time. But
having seen Unification Part 3, I did enjoy some of the Nevar politicking and couldn't help but think of Brexit.
Yep. Yeah. Yes, and things go a bit better for the Vulcans, Romulans, and Federation than that whole mess.
Yeah. And I don't know, it might just be my age, but just, you know, with the cadet part, is kind of, there was that feeling of, oh, come on, guys. You know, stop work. You know, now is not the time to work on your emotional baggage.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting in a way, like the Discovery crew often feel like they're working through their emotional baggage, like they've been through a lot of kind of workplace mandated kind of therapy sessions. And these kids are the much rawer version of that. And I don't know, like my brother's a teacher, and I couldn't help but feel like the sense of how when kids came back to school after being in lockdown for ages, and how like having a lot of those measures, a lot of that socialization removed, kind of just helped create more divides between them. And that sort of thing of going, yeah, they haven't been socialized properly, these kids. And so it goes with this. You know, everyone's had their bad experiences in the grim, dark future that is Star Trek Discovery seasons 3 through 5. But yeah, like one of the key things that I've generally liked about this era of Discovery is the idea that the world, well, the galaxy is shit. We're going to do a Starfleet. We're going to try and Star Trek it up. And these kids, you know, obviously they need to learn to do that themselves as well.
Well, it's not just rebuilding the Federation. It's also building the Starfleet mentality of what they have come from.
Yeah, and you can be a good student with it. But yeah, if you're like Harold and go, who I realized kept sounding like Harold when I was saying it there, but yeah, Harold, his whole, all of his issues and baggage about going, well, you know, he didn't want to lean on his dad being actually a civil rights guy that had done really well, and having to do all of the high achieving stuff because no one likes Orions around these parts. What with
man, poor Tendi.
Yeah,
she tried so hard.
Yeah. Yeah, and then, I guess what, in the grim dark future, it ended up with the Orions doing all the enslaving and all of that. Oh, the irony. But yeah, I'm definitely curious to see if anything of this, whether it's the Academy location that was used, whether any of these characters or anything will pop up in the Starfleet Academy ongoing.
I mean, how excited are you for the Starfleet Academy show?
Moderate.
I'm kind of mid. Like, I'm not going into it like I was with Lower Decks by thinking this is going to be terrible.
Yeah.
But Lower Decks had expectations and previous work from the team working against it. Whereas this, I've watched the trailers and I've seen a lot of the backlash to the trailers with the, oh, this is just Dawson's Creek. I want a proper Star Trek, not Dawson's, like, not Dawson's Creek in space. I'm like, okay, we've just seen a few posters and a few trailers, And the trailers are always cut down to be the most mass consumable by everyone.
I was thinking it wasn't Dawson's Creek enough with those trailers. Like, that the trailers, they're fine. They feel a bit like, oh God, are these Academy kids going to stop some giant existential threat to the entire Federation / universe or something? You know, there's Paul Giamatti as a big nemesis. You know, you've got him and Helen Hunt as kind of cinema level actors doing stuff. And like the poster of the kids just laying around, it was like, cool, okay,
yeah,
good.
It's a group shot. There we go.
Yeah, here we go. Here's our cast. They're a bunch of kids learning, growing.
Like, they're a bunch of attractive kids. Like, yeah, they're attractive kids, I suppose. But it's like, you know, it's not as if the other Star Trek casts weren't missing attractive people in well.
Yes, one of my notes from the DS9 episode we covered with the cold open was, like, Odo, everyone is in love with Jadzia Dax. Like, Quark, that's not going to be a surprise that Quark fancies her.
And it's like, Odo, how long have you had your, are you still in your torrid, will they, won't they romance with Kira, or have you, did a hologram help you learn how to get girls? Yeah.
But yeah, like, I think the book plot was fairly standard downtime fare for Discovery. The Navarre stuff, actually, I enjoyed more than I thought I would. With kind of, you know, just any sort of Star Trek peace talk stuff. Of going, look, you guys both want this to happen, but you can't be visibly seen accepting it all, any ground.
So you have to compromise.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah, it felt a little obvious at sometimes when both sides were going on about compromise, but yeah.
I feel sometimes the earlier part before they crashed on the planet, where Tilly is trying to engage them all in group exercises, felt a little cringe to me.
Oh God, entirely.
Yeah.
But I've had to do icebreaker type things in offices for too many years. And the annoying truth is, a lot of the time it is kind of useful to know who these people are. And here, literally, because it's a TV show and these are, you know, characters of the week. And go, okay, we didn't really get much of Sasha's drama.
No, I thought that Sasha's piloting stuff was going to come on.
Yeah,
it's going to come into play later, but it just doesn't.
No, Gorev and Harrell were dealt with fairly well, as far as that kind of thing goes. I wasn't sure what species Gorev was, to be honest. It took me looking up to go, oh, he's a Tellarite.
I thought he was like a Norsican or something.
Yeah, or like half a couple of different species, because they play with that a bit more in this era of Discovery, of going, well, you know, the ones that are biologically compatible, if they've been stuck together, are going to have been having kids.
Like, there is the Federation president who is a Cardassian, a Bajoran, and a human.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So overall, that was fine. I think it would have been a bit slim if it was just the cadet stuff with the story that went on. But yeah, I liked getting Tilly in a new element.
Well, you have to give Michael Burnham something to do. So she can just walk into a room and go, I'm Michael Burnham, I've got this.
Exactly, yeah, yeah. Hang on, where are you shining that spotlight? That's mine, bitch.
There's Michael Burnham. Hang on. Tilly's getting a moment? Nope.
So yeah. I forgot how much of not the Academy students stuff there was in this, but yeah, like,
do you think, because, you know, David, this is like David Cronenberg's third or fourth time in the role. Do you think they went to David Cronenberg and say, hey, do you want to be in a Star Trek? Or they went, we kind of need a weird guy to be this one doctor. Hey, what about the guy who's the murderer in in the Clive Barker film Nightbreed? And someone goes, oh, you mean Canadian director David Cronenberg? Yeah, let's see what he's doing.
It's an interesting casting.
Especially because I keep expecting him to turn out to be the villain. And it might just be because I've seen him in Clive Barker's Nightbreed, where he plays a serial killer.
Yeah, see, I've not seen Nightbreed. I was watching him and thinking, he looks like he has an NPR podcast that is very serious. And then, yeah, then the credits went. It's like, oh, shit, that's him.
And see, the thing is, for me, it's just like, that's David Cronenberg. He's definitely up to some kind of weird... He's probably up to some weird, like, gene-splicing experiments, which are oh so sexy.
Yeah. Oh, shit. I didn't realize he was also in Alias.
Oh.
Brilliant. But yes, I like him in this role. He's fairly sparingly used and, you know, seems nice and supportive enough, but also there is that edge of mystery. And I don't know, like, again, I don't know if it's for metacasting to go, comes across a little sinister.
Yes. It's like, yeah, of course he is. He's the director of Scanners and The Fly and Crimes of the Future, which is a... Oh, man, have you seen Crimes of the Future?
No.
I went to see Crimes of the Future in the cinema, and I think I was the only person in that audience who was aware of the tone and the subject matter of David Cronenberg's previous films. So when it kind of goes into the psychosexual body horror, I'm just like, yeah, this is Monday for this guy.
Amazing. Oh, dear. That must have been quite the experience for people that didn't know who David Cronenberg was.
Oh, okay. According to this, Cronenberg was approached for the role by showrunner Alex Kurtzman, who's a fan of his work. He said he was oh so cheap and, as a Toronto native, available.
Well, that's what you want.
Well, he was a fan of the original Star Trek.
Fair.
Yeah, fair?
Yeah.
Oh, yep. Okay. Yep, he was in Alias. Oh, man, he was in Jason 10.
Yep.
Well, Jason X, the one where Jason goes... Jason X is amazing because it's dumb.
It's good. Dumb.
It's Jason in space.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, did you come here looking for a good movie? Fuck you. We're going to have a fun time here. He's in space now.
Look, Friday the 13th is a legitimately good slasher thriller. By Jason 10, is just like, where should we take Jason Voorhees into a world unburdened by capitalism? Space!
Well, you know, he's done New York. He's done that. Why not? Why not put him in space?
Well, it'd be cheaper than New Jersey.
I feel like we've run out of points to talk about with this, given our numerous tangents just then.
I mean, you know, like the kids, like, I don't know. I feel like, I think what was missing was a moment where the three cadet kids kind of come together and come up with a plan.
Yeah.
It was very much Tilly going, I'm going to do this, and I'm going to, might die in the attempt. And if I die, that means I don't have to put up your bitching anymore.
It was nice seeing her actually pushed without, you know, kind of like, oh, here's a tense thing, you can angst about it. Or maybe, you know, just like, you know, someone else will do the action stuff. But her actually getting her hands dirty with it all. Admittedly, when it's like, you're going to flee from this monster. Okay, good luck. Like, brave work, but...
Let's go with that.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you're quite right that maybe there should have been some more, like, you know, maybe if Tilly got stuck and the kids would have to work together, that kind of thing.
Because, you know, it sounds like such a tacky Star Trek moment, but there are times when you want the tacky Star Trek moment.
Yeah, Yeah. Okay, so looking at the list, just having a bit of a look, discovery-wise, I see at 120, we've got Stormy Weather, where they get stuck in a big rift full of nothing and need to figure out how to back out of it. And like further down at 153, we've got Saints of Imperfection, where they try and fix Culber and having killed him, which this is definitely better than that.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think Stormy Weather's probably my roof, my ceiling for this.
Definitely. Oh, okay. So, Odo getting dating advice from Hologram is season 6, episode 20. So,
oh god, yeah, up in 142 with His Way.
Yep, and then the Valiant was.
Oh, this is not as good as His Way.
No. Okay, and then Valiant. Okay, Valiant was episode 22 of 6. So, yeah, maybe just because Odo's dating now, he's got another thing to rub in Quark's face.
Yeah.
Also, maybe they're just trying to do some foreshadowing over Dax's death in a few episodes' time.
Maybe. Let's see. So, okay. Is this better or worse than Space Seed?
I know what it's not better than.
Yeah.
Number 151 on the list. Let Sleeping Borg Lie.
Oh, you are very right.
Like, this was good. This was good fun.
Yeah.
But, like, it's... I would say, you know, Let Sleeping Borg Lie is a fantastic use of exploration of the Borg and the nature of assimilation.
Yeah. Okay, so better or worse than their attempt at doing a Knives Out in a space adventure hour, which Ooh. Has only seemed worse since we covered Galaxy Quest.
Yeah, I think this might be slightly better, if only because I really didn't like Space Adventure Hour.
Okay, so that would put this at the new 152.
Works for me.
Yeah, I'm good with that. God, right. We are now at 190 entries on this list. We are on the road to 200. We're going to have to do something suitably big for 200. Now, with all that, that's it for tonight. And anyway, Miles, where can they find us and where can they find you?
Well, they can find me at... You can find me on my blog at mareedlabato.wordpress.com. And you can find me on my Blue Sky at milesreedlabato.bsky.social.
Hey.
And Charlie, what about you?
So, you can find me on skyshark.itch.io on the internet and on Blue Sky, where that is my handle. Also, you can find me on Faked Tales, where I've been writing about 2000 AD and writing about recent X-Men events. Am I going to keep that up? I don't know. But yeah, it's been kind of fun to do, and my way of entertaining myself during an, at best, mid-era of the X-Men. So yes. Also, God, what, when this airs, there might be an issue of Sprigs and Kindling, where I've written some nice seasonal scenes for the Between role-playing game. So yeah, if so, there'll be a link to that in the show notes.
Wonderful.
Yes. You can also find us on ko-fi.com/casualtrek if you want to fling us some money and suggest a theme or a character or something to base an episode on. Yeah, and Casual Trek on Blue Sky and on Facebook.
Yeah.
Cool.
And as always, live long and have a jelly baby.
Yeah, go do a Starfleet, but not like one of those hotshot squads where everyone seems to die or get people killed.
Yes, please. Go do a child death friendly Starfleet.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
You have been listening to Casual Trek, a Nerd and Tie podcast, presented by Charlie Etheridge Nunn and Miles Reed Lobato. Music by Alfred Etheridge Nunn. Star Trek by Paramount. Not us. Not yet.